The first and most striking impression Robert Morris made in the courtroom was that of an unlikely felon. Traditional white-collar criminals, felled by their own greed or malice, were usually much older than this defendant. He was pale and thin, and his new suit seemed a little too large. It was hard not to wonder whether the suit was an imperfect fit intentionally, a subtle message from his defense team. If he's not even old enough to know how to pick a suit, how much of a white-collar criminal could he be? His seeming lack of worldliness was what the defense attorneys wanted to convey to the jury of 9 women and 3 men, many of them with children the defendant's age. In court, his attorneys referred to him as Robert, a kid. Howard G. Munson, the federal district judge in this case, was a 65-year-old Republican whose 14 years on the federal bench had accrued a record of fairness and neutrality in criminal cases. A heavy smoker with a resounding cough and a thunderous voice, Munson had a sharp memory for the details of a case. At the same time, he possessed a knack for extracting the essence from a witness's testimony. In his opening statement to the jurors, Prosecutor Mark Rash told them they would be hearing some difficult technical language, but that shouldn't distract them from what the government intended to prove, that on November 2, 1988, there was a full-scale assault on computers throughout the United States launched by the defendant Robert Tappan Morris. Rash pronounced Robert's middle name Tap-In. This assault was deliberate, planned, calculated, Rash said. It was calculated to break into as many different computers as he possibly could to gain what the law will call unauthorized access. Rash went on. What the government intends to prove is that early in the evening of November 2, 1988, computer scientists throughout the country started noticing that something was going drastically wrong with computers from California to Massachusetts to Florida. All of the computers were starting to slow down. These were computers not just at government sites, not just at military sites, but at commercial facilities, at private companies throughout the country, and many of the people we'll hear testimony from worked at different universities doing scientific research. Their research was interrupted. They couldn't do their work because of the actions of the defendant, Robert Tappan Morris. Valuable computer time was lost. Valuable experiments were lost. People could not communicate with each other. They couldn't talk to each other. They couldn't find out what was going on. Their computers, and you will hear testimony about this, were crashing, stopped running, came to a grinding halt because of the actions of the defendant, Robert Tappan Morris. As Rash described it, Morris had sat for hours at a computer terminal in Upson Hall at Cornell, planning the break-in. It was deliberate. Rash repeated the word deliberate like a mantra. As the time for release of this worm came nearer, he spent more and more time on the computer trying to perfect it. He worked all day on the day of November 2nd trying to launch this worm. It was designed deliberately and intentionally. The prosecutor stopped just short of voicing his private theory that Robert had actually panicked upon seeing that the FTP bug had been fixed and that he rushed to get the worm finished that day before other holes were plugged as well. Moreover, he believed that Robert's rush at the end accounted for some of the careless code in the program. Rash told the jury that he intended to call a collection of witnesses into the courtroom, victims from computer centers throughout the nation who would describe the horrendous events of November 2nd and estimate the dollars lost in the effort to fix their systems. You will hear testimony from the scientists, the engineers who use these computers, that when this thing was attacking them, they didn't know what it was doing. It was designed to hide its effects, to pretend to be an innocuous program. It disguised itself to frustrate the victims of its attack. In explaining what a computer virus was, Rash drew parallels to the biological flus the jurors could all relate to. If you have just one virus, you may not get very sick. But if you get many viruses, if you have hundreds, you will get very sick. Not only will you get very sick, you will get other people sick.
Not only was Rash comfortable with most of the computer arcana that was tossed around in the courtroom, but he did his share of tossing.
And even though Guidoboni had 2 computer experts at his disposal throughout the lengthy preparation for the trial, he was still struggling a bit with some of the concepts. If the case was to be decided on pure technical machismo, Rash would undoubtedly win. The prosecutor reminded the jurors that the government did not intend to prove that Robert was an evil person, and that it did not need to prove that Robert intended to cause the damage he caused. For the jury to return a guilty verdict, Rash said, the government needed only to prove that he intended to obtain unauthorized access and break in. In contrast to Rash's clipped and formal language, Guidoboni adopted a folksy tone. "I guess you can tell from looking at me that I'm not Perry Mason," Guidoboni said. But where Rash was self-assured, Guidoboni was almost apologetic. "I don't have a rabbit to reach down here and pull out of my hat," he said. "That's not the way criminal trials work in real life, so you're going to have to bear with me. We are going to do the best that we can." A few minutes into his speech, in fact, Guidoboni made Robert's confession for him. He acknowledged that his client had indeed written the worm. However, he added, evidence would show that this worm caused no permanent damage, and it was not designed to cause permanent damage. It didn't break into any machines. The virus didn't read anybody's private files, and didn't steal any information, and didn't put $1 into Mr. Morris's pocket. The defense attorney then listed Robert's credentials. Not only did he work hard at summer jobs while at Harvard, but he had made important contributions to the field of computer security. He had written papers that were published, and he had alerted the computer community to security holes in the past. Guidoboni depicted the Internet as a loosely organized, almost ragtag collection of networks. There was no drug czar, if you will, computer czar, sitting up in Washington who has control, who established rules. Moreover, he said, the Internet is not a network that launches missiles. It's used for conducting research and sharing scientific data. It's also used for frivolous things like playing chess, sending love letters, and exchanging recipes.
Guidoboni's speech had an odd air of desperation to it. He wasn't asking so much for a judgment of innocence as for forgiveness. Guidoboni said that he would present evidence showing that Robert's virus was purposely limited, its intention to spread slowly and quietly, but you will hear that he made a mistake, a critical mistake. And in the end, he alerted the computer community that the system wasn't secure and that they needed to take steps to fix it. This in turn caused a lot of embarrassment, but a simple mistake, together with embarrassment and some inconvenience, are not the equivalent of a federal felony offense. Witnesses were what Mark Rash promised, and witnesses were what he delivered. The first witness for the prosecution was Dean Kraft, Cornell's director of computing facilities. Kraft had been pacing outside the courtroom, wondering aloud to another witness how he would be able to explain data decryption to the jury. Kraft described to a mystified jury the process of sorting through Morris's old files and finding early versions of the program. If nothing else, the jury got from Kraft's testimony that this was indeed to be a trial filled with technical terms. Many of the witnesses for the prosecution knew each other, if not personally, then by electronic mail, and if not by electronic mail, then by reputation. Rash and Meltzer had selected their witnesses carefully. They represented a good cross-section of the nation's computer system managers. They traveled to Syracuse from universities, Army research labs, and other government institutions. Local reporters joked that they were disappointed to see the witnesses weren't wearing pocket protectors, which they believed to be a computer nerd's signal of pertinence. Mark Brown, the University of Southern California system manager who had battled Kevin Mitnick, was the second witness. He gave the first in what would become a blur of testimony about the devastation of November 2, 1988. Brown testified that when he logged into his computer that night at about 11 p.m. California time, he saw dozens of strange programs running. Even after Brown killed them, they were back within minutes. The situation threw Brown and others in the computer center into a state of panic. "We'd never seen anything this widespread," he told the court. "We had no idea if it was modifying the data on the files." So at 6 a.m., to prevent infections from coming in and going out, Brown disconnected the university's computers from the Internet. To prevent reinfection, Brown had to turn off the computers, halting file transfers, cutting off electronic mail, and bringing all research to a halt. In the end, 350 Suns and Vaxes on the USC campus were infected. And so it went, in painstakingly systematic fashion. Rash and Meltzer called computer managers to the stand, and one after another, they described the mayhem that ensued after the worm hit their institutions. In endless litany, witnesses told of realizing they were under attack, of taking computers off the network, of crawling under their desks and pulling the computer's plugs. The prosecutors asked each witness how many hours he and his colleagues spent ridding his computers of the worm. Estimates of the damages to each institution varied wildly from $200 to $54,000, and the total climbed steadily until it reached $150,000. And how much was their time worth? If anything was to sink in with this jury, it was that people who work with computers make good money. One witness valued his time at $21 an hour, another at $22.38. Was Robert Tap-In Morris authorized to use those computers? No, came the replies. At times, the courtroom transformed into an introductory computer class, as witnesses attempted to explain complex and often baffling technical terms to the jury. The prosecutors submitted as evidence dozens of documents containing page after page of abstruse computer code, prompting a rebuke from Judge Munson. For those of us educated in the 40s, most of this is totally incomprehensible, the judge told the attorneys. I don't see what good it would do for the jurors. In his cross-examination of the prosecution's witness, Guidoboni had them state that the worm caused no damage, and he tried to establish that much of the time they devoted to working on the problem was spent in pure intellectual pursuit, analyzing the worm once it had already been eradicated. The most brilliant moment for the defense came in Guidoboni's cross-examination of Keith Bostick, the Berkeley system manager in charge of Berkeley Unix. The prosecutor had Bostick tell of the catatonic state the Berkeley computers were in and the exhausting decompilation effort. But Guidoboni asked Bostick whether the worm had, in fact, alerted the computer science community to security flaws in SendMail and Finger. As a result of the worm, asked Guidoboni, the SendMail program was a little better, wasn't it? That is correct, Bostick responded. And it certainly was more secure. That is correct. By this time Bostick was smiling. And the same thing for Finger, is that not correct? That is correct, Bostick answered. As long as Guidoboni was on a roll, there was another matter he wanted to clear up with Bostick. It was the question of authorized access. Didn't programs such as Finger and FTP extend to anyone who used them a certain measure of access to all the computers which the programs ran? Bostick tilted his head, as if this were the first time he had considered the question. Yes, it does, he answered. So might it be possible that in a sense Robert Morris was authorized to use any computer that could run those programs? Bostick agreed that he was. After each witness testified, reporters followed him outside for more interrogation. Does Robert Morris deserve prison? I certainly hope he is convicted and sent to prison, said one angry computer manager. Otherwise, it will be open season on the whole network. The manager from the Army Research Lab had a slightly different view. It would be bad to put someone like this in prison. He could learn things and become a real threat.